Perfect. Okay. Let us get started. I think it's time. So, dear guests and colleagues, my name is Aydoğan, and I'm a senior lecturer in religious studies at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to the first seminar in our series titled Perspectives on Death, Afterlife, and Reincarnation. By looking at the list, I can see that some of you are joining not only from other cities in Australia, but I see some of you joining from Indonesia, I think someone from Germany, US, Turkey, Pakistan, and many other places, which is just amazing. So welcome to you all. I start by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as traditional owners of the land on which I work and live now for nearly 7 years. And I pay my respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. Now, before introducing you, our wonderful speaker today, I want to say a few words on the research project that we are running at Monash University that focuses on the theme of these seminars: afterlife, reincarnation, and immortality. In the past few decades, we have seen some exciting research that sheds new light on the process of death. Since the 1970s, improvements in resuscitation technology have enabled maybe millions of people to come back to life after cardiac arrest. An increasing number of people have been reporting what is called near-death experiences, or maybe more thought-provokingly named by some researchers as reported experiences of death. These narratives, coming from different parts of the world, have remarkable similarities. They commonly mention out-of-body experiences, these narratives about near-death experiences coming from different parts of the world have interesting similarities. They mention out-of-body experiences, a very real sense of peace and painlessness, of being back home, feeling at home, or various sensory phenomena, such as seeing an intense light that doesn't hurt eyes, or a tunnel with a bright light, and paradoxically, lucidity, where senses are more focused and clearer than usual. Now, when the heart stops pumping and blood stops flowing to the brain in cardiac arrest, any meaningful cortical activity will end in a few seconds, roughly in 20 seconds. Yet, a study recently showed that 45% of near-death experiences after cardiac arrest reported that their thinking was clearer than usual, rather than malfunctioning or stopping to function at all. Such experiences lead to positive transformative effects, and they dramatically reduce the fear of death. A study on 350 near-death experiencers found out that around half of them became convinced of the survival of life after death. Some consciousness researchers themselves are open to this commonplace idea of afterlife. In a study conducted in 1996, 57 out of a sample of 212 consciousness researchers agreed that personal consciousness continues after physical death. As many of you may know, most of the world's population believes in afterlife, including 46 to 60% of those with no religious affiliation. That, maybe as one professor of psychology argues in recent books, is not an end of consciousness maybe, but the start of an altered state of consciousness. Similarly, puzzling cross-cultural data is accumulating on alleged past life memories, which is also quite interesting. Child psychiatrists working on 2,500 cases of children who claim to remember past lives also came up with interesting arguments. For example, they argue for a correspondence between the presence of unexplained phobias or birthmarks and the manner of death of the purported previous personality. In the last three decades, 78 studies were published in major indexed scientific journals on such remembered past lives, and more than 80% of them were focusing on children and generally discussing this phenomenon of remembering past lives within the context of another widely held religious belief, reincarnation. The transfer of life force or consciousness stream of a human being to the body of another being. Beliefs in reincarnation are also quite widespread around the world. Local interpretations of different cultures and religious traditions did accommodate forms of reincarnation throughout the history. In our research project at Monash, we are not trying to find scientific answers to these exciting questions asked by neuroscientists, psychiatrists, or cognitive scientists. Rather, we want to situate the study of religion in conversation with these expanding empirical studies, findings, and discussions. Afterlife, reincarnation, and salvation are perpetual topics of religious, philosophical, and wisdom traditions around the globe, and we want to take a fresh look at them in light of our changing scientific understandings of death. What are the approaches that they bring to the non-finality of death and to the meaning of afterlife? We will shed light on the diversity of approaches to the question of afterlife within different religious traditions in opposition to their monolithic or homogeneous depictions. In our project, we will also translate some forgotten ancient primary sources into English, and we will develop a general bibliographical database for researchers and colleagues. During this year, our seminars will look at different religious traditions around the world to provide our audience a broad cross-cultural insight into the non-finality of death. In the second year of our project, we will focus on modern approaches to that from different academic disciplines and from modern religious spiritual interpretations and movements. So that was a quick summary of what we will be doing during the next 2 years. The ideal place to start our cross-cultural survey is, of course, the rich wisdom tradition of the territories where I am now located. Australia is home to the oldest known continuous civilization on Earth, with ancestries stretching back around 75,000 years. So I am delighted to start our series with a focus on Indigenous Australian traditions and to pay the due respect to this vast wisdom heritage. The title of today's talk is The Endless Rhythm of Life, Dying, Initiation, and Rebirth in Indigenous Australian Hierophonics. And our speaker is Dr. Vasilis Adraktas from Western Sydney University. Vasilis will deliver a 40-minute recorded talk followed by a 10-minute unrecorded Q&A session. For those of you who don't know him, Vasilis is a comparative religionist who has published widely on early Christianity, Byzantine philosophy, ancient Greek religion, Islam, and indigenous Australia. In addition to a large number of academic articles, he has authored, edited, and co-edited more than 10 books. So without further ado, I will leave the floor to Vasilis. Thank you so much, dear Vasilis, for starting our series. It's wonderful to have you here with us. And now I'm leaving the floor to you.
Thank you, Erdogan. Can you hear me loud and clear? Yes, thank you. It's my pleasure and honor to kick off this series of the seminars. on this very, very interesting topic. I would like to thank you and, of course, all the team that is involved in the in putting together these seminars. And without, you know, further ado, myself, I want to, you know, go straight ahead into the topic so we have time for discussion. I will start with an introduction. In the case of Indigenous Australian religions, death is not simply a topic to be studied amongst others. In reality, it constitutes the core of Indigenous Australian hierophantics. Everything in any given Indigenous life world, Lebenswelt, from the very moment of birth and throughout all rites of passage, is death-oriented. So much so that Indigenous Australian living seems to be a typical, albeit peculiar, case of a platonic study of death, meleti thanatu. However, it is such a study not thanks to philosophy, but through initiation. The latter should not be seen as a figurative type of dying, common in many contexts from a cross-religious perspective, but as an actual death experience, whereby living black and dying black are sides of the same coin, or to put it better, fuse into one. It is this dialectic of life and death, this endless dialectic, that can be signified by the term rebirth, as hinted at by the concept of the so-called spirit children. The present paper attempts to show the experiential continuum that dying, initiation, and rebirth make up in the case of Indigenous Australian hierophantics. What comes forth in this respect is an all-encompassing anthropology of death that reflects a phenomenology of being. And here, when I say being, I have in my mind Heidegger's Dasein, which is illustrative of what I would like to call the hierophantics of sameness, as juxtaposed to the hierophantics of otherness, embodied by what we conventionally define as monotheism. In this life order of sameness, reincarnation, metempsychosis, or transmigration have been used and discussed scholarly in the past, but without unfortunately considering the nuances involved therein. Nevertheless, it's precisely these nuances that render the reincarnational dialectics of living and dying black the anthropological concomitant of the rhythmic realization of dreamings in any given place or country. Furthermore, only rarely has the phenomenology of Indigenous beliefs and practices regarding death been problematized in their colonial contextuality by looking into the impact and or dialogic of Christianity. But perhaps this contextuality is the most pertinent starting point for the discussion I'm engaging in. Let's start then with a series of interrelated questions. Why should death even be a problem in the context of Australian religiosity? I mean, why would death pose an issue within the incessant rhythmic movement of topos, locality, from and to itself? Firstly, one could say that as an experience of the living, death does constitute a challenge as to the very meaning of life. In this respect, the answers given by the Indigenous peoples of Australia saw death, in one way or another, as the ultimate moment within the movement of topos towards self-awareness. This is exactly where initiation and rebirth find their proper place. Notwithstanding this, Indigenous story dreamings, in the form, of course, in which they have been preserved, seem to reflect an intense problem with death. To pose the latter as a problem that requires a solution. The explanation that I would like to put forward with regards to the above is that the forms in which we have come to know these storied dreamings are already witnesses to a shift that has taken place from the priority of black topos to the demands of white utopia. In other words, indigenous story dreamings have already internalized non-indigenous influences and thus have attempted to articulate answers that may secure, negotiate some kind of position for the priority of place within highly different conditions of being compared to pre-colonial times. These conditions range from a relative undermining of place in the face of life worlds that are informed by a temporal development of life, such as Indonesian ones, on the one hand, to a radical displacement of place, if I may say so, in the wake of the utopianism of Western Christianity, on the other. In either case, this spectrum of interference seems to have been the background process that ended up giving the guise of reincarnation to what otherwise has been the endless rhythm of life in Indigenous Australian hieroponics. Now, some things about methodology. From an analytical ethic point of view, dying, initiation, and rebirth could be distinguished from one another by utilizing the Lacanian triptych of the real, le réel, the symbolic, le symbolique, and the imaginary, l'imaginaire. Undoubtedly, however, these three aspects are intrinsically intertwined from an experiential, emic perspective, since for Indigenous agents, dying, initiation, and rebirth are virtually coterminous. They happen together. But then, in what sense do they differ, or to put it slightly differently, why do they differ? Dying as the level of the real is a biological, objective, and definitive order of life forms, Lebensformen. There is no choice involved here. Initiation at the level of the symbolic represents a social, communal, and mediatory order of life forms. Everything here is a matter of communication. Lastly, rebirth as the level of the imaginary stands for a religious, subjective, intersubjective, and fuzzy order of life forms. It is here where identification is produced. Throughout my presentation, this distinction at the same time unity in the way just described is taken for granted. It is also a kind of theorization that I regard as enabling one to talk reasonably and coherently about the interrelations and transactions between these three aspects of Indigenous Australian hierophantics. Moreover, I should add that the specific methodology I follow here draws on both the history and the phenomenology of religion. This, along with the fact that I make so much use of the terminology of hierophantics, betrays that my approach is highly indebted to the insights of Mircea Eliade, although I would not call it a historical phenomenology, but rather a hierophantic hermeneutics of Indigenous Australian life forms. This specific methodological transmutation has taken place thanks to a broad and substantial qualifications regarding the work of the renowned Romanian scholar, and for that matter, qualifications that would not have been possible without the influence of anthropologist W.E.H. Stana. More specifically, in my hermeneutic approach, what Stana dubbed the dreaming corresponds to what Indigenous people regard as the sacred. As to the multiple and diverse local dreamings, which by the way are the actually observable religionswissenschaftliche data, they correspond to what Eliade calls hierophanies. Furthermore, in the Indigenous Australian context, the sacred profane distinction refers to a highly dialectical field of experiences, both in relation to white and black life forms. From a structural point of view, in particular, the elements of this dialectic can be oppositional or interchangeable or socially ambivalent. Thus, the hierophantics of the communal experiencing of death may range from a profane, id est disruptive, to an ambivalent, id est challenging, to a most sacred, id est consolidating understanding of death. It is the latter that renders dying the indigenous religious manifestation par excellence, or to term it otherwise, the greatest indigenous business. Before entering the proper discussion of my topic, I would like to present the working hypothesis that informs my entire understanding. In order to be as concise as possible, I would phrase the hypothesis in the following way. For the indigenous peoples of Australia, dying constitutes the necessary and sufficient condition that enables a member of any people, that is a personal dreaming or otherwise a very specific human manifestation of a given place, to maintain through their remaining within that specific place, people, that is within a people dreaming, or otherwise the broader human life order of the place, their vital identification, which is none other than the awareness of the dreaming, that is the human life world of the place in its entirety. Death as a problem. It is quite telling that with regards to the different local rituals throughout Australia, anthropologist Kenneth Maddock notes emphatically in his The Australian Aborigines, A Portrait of Their Society, that the indigenous people are obsessed with death. Along the same lines, Stanner, when referring to Mulungu, the last and most important mortuary ritual of the Marimpata, states that according to their understanding, it is greater than Punj, that is the most important of the tribe's initiations. Both examples illustrate adequately, I believe, the fact that death is a major concern in Indigenous Australian hierophantics, a concern so conspicuous that scholars couldn't fail to acknowledge, but at the same time too opaque for them to appreciate its meaning. It would be worthwhile, though, to ponder on the meaning by reflecting on two story dreamings from Northern Territory, one from the Yarralin, which has been dubbed the myth of the moon and the dingo, and one from the Marimpata, the myth of the crab and the crow. The first one. The moon was talking, saying, "You want to die? Die then. Bones to bones. Kujilip." Kujilip means the place to which the moon's bones had to return. But what it really means now is that the moon was becoming hard. That Walaku, that is the dingo, said, "Try, teach me how to go there." Jacqueline was dead. Jacqueline is the moon, and appeared for 4 nights. But the dingo said, "You will not be able to see me for 4 nights, for 4 days. I will leave forever." And thus Walaku died and everybody forgot him. Some other Walaku was talking and saying, that's how we have to go. And yes, that's how we go and everything is fine. And the dingo could not bring about any change. I do not know the reason that Jacqueline should have said, the moon should have said, "Oh, that's bad. It's not good to stay there like that. Why don't you return?" That Walaku made a mistake. Definitely. Another dingo was there and said, "That's right. Come back, come back. Start a new life. And you shall die and shall return with new life." In vain. So the Walakum made a mistake. But you wonder, which life is good? Jacqueline, that moon, which we were not able to follow. We followed the dingo. We will never bring about any change. We should have followed that moon. Now the second story, dreaming. The crab was a very old woman, and she was very sick. Everyone thought that she was dead. They buried her in a pit, but she wasn't dead. She stayed there for 5 days. She got a new shell and left the old one in the ground. The crow was there waiting. The people were crying. Ah, that crab was there. The old woman had returned. Everybody was happy. But the crow was angry and said to the crab, "This way takes too long. Here is what we humans have to do." And at once, the crow plucked out its own eyes, and then it died immediately. Although these two story dreamings come from areas that are geographically close, they are typical of the differentiation that one is confronted with from one clan, place, people to another. A differentiation, though, that ultimately expresses common concerns and involves some basic analogies. The common concerns expressed therein include the questions regarding the why, the inevitable character or not, as well as the meaning of death, whereas the most evident of the analogies seem to be the notions of clash and mistake. The myth of the moon and the dingo addresses the why of death by connoting failure and inexpediency. Humans failed or didn't act appropriately with regards to the possibility of immortality. Consequently, death was not in principle, nor at the beginning, an inevitable condition. On the contrary, it was rendered thus afterwards. But it is worth noting that the condition of death, precisely as inevitable, has, or better, acquired a very specific meaning. Deborah Rose, who documented this story dreaming, comments on it as follows. The dingo, just like its descendants, it has human beings, is open towards life, participating both in the end that death entails and the continuity of the parts. Our ancestor, the dingo, opens us up to the world, something that requires that we come to an understanding of our place within it, a place that is radically different from that of the moon. Death and its concomitant, it as birth, open up people towards time and the sharing of life. We are participants in the processes of life. We kill and we eat. We die and our bones feed the earth, giving back the life to the places and the species that sustain us. On the other hand, the myth of the crab and the crow addresses the why of death through the notions of damage and decay. Humans die because they suffer damage and decay. That is, death results from the mistreatment of life. So once again, one could say that for this story dreaming as well, death neither was nor is inevitable. Furthermore, concerning its meaning, it seems that the latter consists in the hope of immortality, or to be precise, in the place and role of death within life. Stanner, who has preserved this myth, is emphatic in this connection. But death was only bodily. In my view, Rose has captured correctly the general meaning of the myth she elaborates on. However, this is not a story that is arguing in favor of immortality and against death in a kind of general and abstract manner. Rather, this is a story on the immortality of everything and thus about the role that the death of each and everything plays in the greater scheme of life. In other words, the immortality of the moon dreaming, while it constitutes a desirable condition of existence, ends up being an undesirable one, precisely because it is realized as an absolute over against all other dreamings. The moon dreaming constitutes in itself a closed totality, that neither produces nor receives anything, whereas the entirety of all other dreams, precisely through and thanks to death, links everything to some other, securing thus the movement of life. Hence, the immortal moon is already dead, while the mortal descendant of the dingo, it is the human being, is truly alive. Nevertheless, I think that Rose's comments on the connection that she postulates between death and temporality are misleading. Basically, Indigenous Australians were never interested in time, but in place. The story dreaming she relates does not intend to convey that time came into existence via death, but that due to death, the integrity of place is threatened. If humans and all other dreamings die, and that's the end to it, then how can place, which by the way constitutes the source of their existence, maintain its own awareness alive? A place is place because it is substantiated as a people, that is, as the consciousness of its identity, its very abidingness, and this through all forms, dreamings of life. Thus, in the case that all dreamings were immortal, just like the moon, then there would be no problem at all. But even now that they are all mortal, again, there is no problem, for the one gives the other its own life. However, one should always be aware that this truth does not stem from the story itself, but from the broader hierophantic context to which it belongs. On the other hand, I regard Stana as interpreting correctly the myth of the crab and the crow, when he refers to the liminality that characterizes the very structure of life. Life, the process of existence, he writes, has been determined and thus has been limited, having death as its great limit, by its very structure. It is the structure of life that has determined for the latter the entire range of its possibilities. But in what sense does the liminality of death render the latter unnatural? Because it was something that had to be shown, something that had to be taught. But isn't this one of the most typical activities of the ancestor dreamings? At this point, I think that Stanner is wrong. The liminality of death is not unnatural because, according to the myth, it is the result of teaching. On the contrary, it is natural precisely because, according to the myth, it has been taught to humans. Otherwise, immortality would have been the privilege of certain dreamings, or it would be equivalent to the risk of an unknown outcome. Moreover, the story dreamings under discussion talk directly of clash and mistake. Clash comes forth more in the second story, whereas mistake is far more the case in the first one. In particular, death is presented as the result of some kind of clash between the ancestor dreamings, or termed differently, it constitutes the outcome of the internal dialectical tension of the dreaming. In other words, thanks to and through death, the hierophantic opposition of dreamings reaches its outmost limit and thus hints at the unity of the dreaming. It is the sacred. These remarks are quite relevant as to the dynamics of the social relations in any given clan, both internally and externally. The dreaming of death is substantiated symbolically in every case of actual, real death. The clash is detected, and the agent responsible for the mistake is brought to account. Ostensibly, all this corresponds to the ceremonial process known in the anthropological literature as inquest, which is so common, especially in the case of the death of young people or sudden death, and the aim of which is to find the killer, inverted commas, and renegotiate the disrupted unity within the social domain. Imagining life after death. Indigenous Australians never regarded biological death as the end of existence, since corporeal reality is understood only as one of the many moving, incessantly and rhythmically, manifestations of the fundamental reality of place. Although death signifies the end of a course, a life journey, during which a certain set of relationships are performed, human beings as spirit children are inseparably and inherently linked to ancestor dreamings and by extension, their dreaming. Indeed, it would not be an exaggeration to say that human beings are understood as eternal. In this respect, death is perceived as a transition that is inscribed within the dreaming by constituting a particular locality and modality of the latter's self-awareness. But in this connection, the question is raised or could be raised as to what happens after death, or otherwise, what exactly is the transition affected by death? Personally, I agree with those who claim that pre-colonially, this question was not raised. To put it differently, the answer was self-evident and there was no waste of energy in proposing probable or reasonable representations regarding life after death. Simply put, spirit children were regarded as returning to the source of their emanation in order to realize again and again another human dream, whenever, of course, that would come up, so to speak. Notwithstanding, even a cursory reading of the relevant bibliography suffices to convince one that not only there are representations of life after death in Indigenous Australia, but they are indeed complex, complicated, and many a time so diverse in terms of content that they end up being blatantly self-contradictory. However paradoxical this may sound, it is not unexplainable if one considers that the cases where the question about life after death was in fact raised belong, as it is expected, to colonial, post-colonial Indigenous contexts. Consequently, these representations constitute witnesses regarding the presence of non-Indigenous post-death beliefs, which Indigenous people attempt to accommodate within the parameters and the existential horizon of the dreaming. One, life after death according to the peoples of Southeast Australia. According to these peoples, eloquently described in Howitz, the native tribes of Southeast Australia, at the time of death, the spirit, inverted commas, that is a number of different Indigenous terms that could tentatively be translated as spirit, abandons the body, a condition that facilitates its acting in multiple ways. Thus, it can visit someone who is asleep or someone who has left their own body in a shamanic, let's say, type of trance. Now, the usual reason for such a visit is to provide someone with help against a witch doctor or to cure a person from a disease. But again, it might just be because the spirit has a desire to be with a beloved person or wants to cause harm to an enemy. Another possibility for the spirit of a dead person might be its roaming in the wilderness for an indefinite period during which it consumes foods and gets warmed up next to abandoned fireplaces. It may also find refuge near one's burial site or in the trunk of a big tree. Or again, it may haunt the place where it used to inhabit, going about at night and attacking unsuspecting or careless hunters. There is, though, a third case of beliefs regarding life after death in this part of the country. According to these, when one dies, their spiritual, inverted commas, substance presents itself as dual and breaks up with regards to its after-death course. More specifically, one finds amongst the people of Southeast Australia the belief that humans actually have two spirits. One of them heads towards the sky, and the other either remains on Earth next to its familiar places or finds its way to the sea in the regions of the West. To be sure, the spiritual part that stays in the sky or upon the earth does not do so in a permanent and unchanging fashion, for moving from one to the other level is indeed possible. Moving from the earth towards the sky resembles very much the so-called shamanic techniques of witch doctors, whereas the return from the sky to the earth is closely related to the desire of the dead to reveal to those alive a number of secrets that might prove useful to them. In any case, however, two other details that need to be highlighted in this connection. Firstly, the conditions in the sky are definitely better than what they are on Earth. And secondly, wherever it is believed that the spirits return from the sea, they are always presented as returning in the guise of white people. Two, life after death, according to the peoples of Central Australia. This is truly a vast region, and so I will limit myself to the Arrernte. And this because it seems that this indigenous people features the purest, so to say, version of the reincarnation motif. According to Theodore Strello, the Arrernte espouse the existence of two souls, one that is associated with the normal conception of a person by their parents, and another which enters into the embryo at a given time and at a given site of a sacred place. It is this second soul, the part of some ancestor dreaming, that remains after death to the sacred place that constitute its very identity. Strictly speaking, what has been dubbed reincarnation in the indigenous life worlds of Central Australia is nothing else than the most characteristic amongst the indigenous beliefs regarding the condition of life after death. And this because this reincarnation is in effect a sort of rationalization of the hierophantic experience regarding the abiding identification between place, people, and ancestors. To put it differently, through their teaching about reincarnation, the Arrernte confirm their belief in their inherent unity with their ancestors' dreamings, a fact that simply renders redundant all types of questioning with regards to the after-death journey of the spirit. Nevertheless, one should emphasize, according to the Arrernte reincarnation is not a cycle of existence that goes through time and again the points of matter and spirit, which in such an understanding would constitute the fundamental binary of the real. On the contrary, this is all about the lively rhythm of this or that dreaming that resonates with the vital rhythms of different dreamings. In this manner, every given place people make up a symphony that is affected, and why not performed, according to the course of self-awareness. What looks like the cycle and circle of reincarnation of any dreaming into all other dreamings is in reality a song dreaming that conveys the movement of a place from and to the dreaming. And the latter, simply put, does not obey any sort of cyclical causality or other type of recurrence. It just moves out of silence towards polyphony, and from there it goes back to silence. Three, life after death according to the peoples of North Australia. According to the description of Stana, the Marimpata believe that after death, the body falls down, the breath or wind ceases, and the shadow stays still, whereas the spirit lives on. Exactly the same takes place, albeit not with so much certainty, with the image slash copy slash reflection slash complement of a person. Now, what happens thereafter as the spirit is something that is very hard to ascertain. There was a lot of talk, Steiner writes, on the one hand about a double death. More specifically, one's ghost or specter gets to transform into a butterfly, which takes on the colors of the earth where the burial takes place. And on the other hand, about a transition during which the spirit either uses a medium to lead it into a new uterus or transform itself or a woman into the figure of that medium in a way that identifies it with both. Furthermore, Steiner adds that it remains a subject of much speculation whether the one looking for a woman was the spirit child itself or its medium guide. Anyhow, one thing was beyond doubt. After death, the spirit traveled far away, and that is the reason that many Marimpata were regarded as embodiments, re-embodiments of people from other indigenous places and people. One of the many peculiarities of the sacroscape of North Australia concerning beliefs on life after death is the widespread image of the land of the dead. More specifically, in the northeastern parts of Arran Land, one comes across a triple division of the spirit at the moment of death. According to this division, the first part goes to the dreaming source from which it originated. The second constitutes a kind of trickster that roams the land, while lastly, the third heads to the land of the dead, where it fuses with the ancestor dreamings that abide there. To be sure, every place in Indigenous Australia has its own distinctive land of the dead. For instance, in the eastern parts of the Kimberleys, this destination of the spirits lies in the west, while in the northeastern parts of Arran Land, the Yirrijah moiety identifies it with one of the Torres Strait Islands jointly with the southern coast of New Guinea, and the Dua moiety identifies it with the island Bargu. It's all about the pleroma of life. I hope my approach thus far has shown how much significant the peculiarly indigenous experiential meaning-making with regards to dying, namely death as initiation, is within the hierophantic life forms of Indigenous Australia. Basically, what I have tried to do is to clarify several ways or strategies of handling and by extension rationalizing death, always keeping in mind that these ways or strategies have been operative in very specific social-cultural contexts. These contexts are lived out with, through, and as dreamings by Indigenous peoples. That is, as abiding events that become symbolically and imaginarily visible or perceivable thanks to the narrative dramatization of stories and songs. These abiding events make up the way that the human existence as pre-existence, bodily existence, and after existence must follow in order to connote with the rhythm of the dreaming and to resonate. Consequently, the human condition is nothing else than a way of living within the real that activates one's responsibility to be conscious and supportive of the rhythmic structure of reality. However, this way of living should not be seen so much as an eternal return of everything in illo tempore, but rather as an attempt to keep the human existence incessantly tuned in with the abiding rhythm of a given place. If I were to delineate this attempt, I would put it as follows. One, it starts, inverted commas, with the human conceiving of the so-called spirit children, which constitute the multiple, differentiated, and at the same time, actual presence of an ancestor dreaming in a specific place. Two, consequently, it goes through a series of initiations, the purpose of which is to bring forth the dreamings into the space of consciousness. And finally, three, it ends, inverted commas, with death as the most direct and complete access to the desirable unity of the dreaming. Thus, everything within this incessant rhythm, from the most collective to the most individual entity, and from the most exceptional to the most ordinary, has a hierophant quality. That is, it constitutes a dreaming. To phrase it in a different way, I would dare say that it is the envisioned unity of all these dreamings that hints imaginarily at the horizon of the dream sacred as the silent postulate that substantiates the hierophantic symbolizations involved therein. Notwithstanding, this is not about a theoretical postulate, but about an empirical postulate that emerges from within the relentless event specter of death. If place, people, and particular dreamings must be abiding, then the end that seems to occur with death cannot but be, or if you prefer, has to be, the confirmation par excellence of their abiding nature, that is, the supreme initiation into the dreaming. It is precisely the specific relationship between death and the dreaming that seems to be reflected in that detail, so to speak, of the story dreamings, according to which nearly all ancestors, after completing their work upon the land, get to be incorporated once again in the earth. That is, they return to the condition of sleeping, a condition that anthropologically corresponds to the experience of death. I would like to conclude with some reflections on the relationship between place and the body in light of death. As already noted, every indigenous people constitutes a manifestation of place, and hence they are inextricably and rhythmically linked with the manifestations of the ancestors' dreamings of this or that place. More specifically, it is within, through, and on the land that ancestor dreamings inscribe themselves. Thus, in this respect, it is not people that own place, but place that owns people. In other words, people are conceivable only in the context of the interconnections and transactions of dreamings that take place as topos, happen, occur, and are realized as place. Moreover, this intrinsic relationship has its concomitant in another relationship, the one between place, in particular a specific sacred site, and the human body. The latter is understood and experienced not as the precondition or prerequisite for an autonomous individuality, but rather as another manifestation of the collectiveness of place slash people. In this way, one can trace in the hierophantics of Indigenous Australia a peculiar negation or denial of the body, which nevertheless should not be seen as a negation or denial of death, but as a transcendence of death. Such a mentality is only natural and expected to treat in a peculiar, that is, a hierophantic manner, the return of the body to place. It is the source of its origin. Indeed, through the set and series of ceremonies, rituals, and initiations regarding death, what is realized is the direct and complete positioning, repositioning of a given human life form dreaming within the matrix of all life forms dreamings. And further on, the transition to the pulsating pleroma of the dreaming. Thank you.